Final case for hearing this morning is number 2009-849, Board of Education for Toledo Public Schools versus Lucas County Board of Revision. And the appellant is Michaelmas Manor and Vistula Management Company. Mr. Wilkins.
May it please the court. My name is Doug Wilkins, represent the appellants. This is an appeal from an order of the Board of Tax Appeals to remand with instructions to dismiss. I would, at the outset, like to clarify for this court exactly what the BTA did. In its decision, it made the determination that Vistula Management did not file the appeal in a representative capacity. That's indicated on pages 3 and 4 of the decision. There is no reference whatsoever to section 5715.19. There is no suggestion in the decision that Vistula Management Company, because it's not listed in that statute, has no power to file the appeal. In fact, the motion that was filed by the BOE makes no reference to section 571519. Cites but one case and makes but one argument. And that argument was precisely what the BTA ruled on, which was Vistula Management did not fill out the complaint in a representative capacity. Now that's very clear because the Wilkinson case, in my opinion, is right on point and directly conflicts with the holding of the BTA in this case. And if you look carefully at the Wilkinson decision, which is attached to the brief, the BTA notes that the receiver filled out the complaint almost identical to the way Vistula Management did. In other words, in the second full paragraph of the Wilkinson's decision, it says, a review of the original complaint discloses that the owner of the property was properly identified on line one as Fisher Acquisition and Development Corp. Line 2 of the complaint lists Grant W. Wilkinson, Esquire, as the complainant, if not owner. The complaint was further signed by counsel who further identified himself as the court-appointed receiver. Now, that's precisely what happened in this case. Now, the Wilkins decision goes on to say that appellant argues in its motion that revised code 5715.19 does not list a court-appointed receiver as a person or entity which may bring a Board of Revision complaint in the state of Ohio. Now, I hope this court takes note of the fact that the same BOE in the Wilkinson decision is the BOE in this case. The same counsel for the BOE, with the exception of Ms. Grigsby, who was not involved, but Mr. Bragg, who was, is the person who argued this case. This case was decided in September of 08. It's not even mentioned in the brief, the motion to dismiss with instructions to remand. It's just completely ignored. Now, in my response to the motion, I cite this case to the BTA. In its decision in this case, there's no analysis, explanation as to why Wilkinson doesn't apply. Now, what Wilkinson does, and then again I'm reading from the decision, is it goes to Dayton Supply. Now I understand the distinction of Dayton Supply to the facts in this case. Dayton Supply dealt with the issue of whether a non-attorney can file a complaint, and the Supreme Court talks about fiduciary duties. My point is that in the Wilkinson decision, the BTA, in a fact pattern very similar to this one, says, in Dayton Supply, the court looked to the relationship between the agent and the property owner to elicit whether a fiduciary duty of accountability and loyalty existed. That language is precisely why the BTA allowed a court-appointed receiver, who's not specifically listed in the statute, to file a complaint on behalf of the owner, because that receiver had statutory fiduciary duties. Now, in this case, the BOE says, okay, so what? You're a management company, but you don't derive fiduciary duties from a statute. Now, in response, this court has held that fiduciary duties, and this was the Dayton Supply case, can arise by express terms, not necessarily from a statute, but from a contract. Now, in response to the motion to dismiss, I submitted to the BTA the HUD-mandated management agreement. This is a subsidized project, 94 units, that are exclusively handled by Vistula Management Company. Vistula Management Company signs all leases, recertifies all tenants, takes care of all of the maintenance, does all the tax returns, does all the reports to all government agencies. And on page 16 of the supplement, which is the pertinent page, has the exclusive duty and responsibility for filing tax reduction appeals. The owner has no knowledge of anything that relates to subsidized property. The owner has no involvement in any of this. Now, counsel for the BOE says, well, I'm sorry, the statute says that management companies cannot file. Strict interpretation, you can't file. Well, neither can court-appointed receivers. So the question that this court has to ask itself is, what was the intent of the General Assembly when it broadened the number of persons that could file under 1-9? In my opinion, it follows the same analysis that this court took in Dayton Supply, which was, who has a fiduciary duty? Spouses, trustees, officers, management companies sanctioned by the Department of Housing and Urban Development certainly have fiduciary duties. I could take you page by page through the management agreement, which has been completely ignored by the BTA, and I could show you fiduciary duties on every single page.
That's in the record?
Yes, sir. It's also part of the supplement. And in my brief, I cite you to the specific pages which indicate the fiduciary duties that exist. Now, do we want to step back and take form over substance and say, I'm sorry, but under that statute, management companies are not specifically listed? Or do we want to look at the intent of the General Assembly? Did it intend to exclude court-appointed receivers? I doubt it. If it's going to allow a spouse to file a reduction, and a court-appointed receiver, which is entrusted by statute with doing what's in the best interest of the owner, then why would the legislature want to preclude a court-appointed receiver? A better question. When a decision comes out from the BTA that puts the public on notice that it is recognizing entities that are not within the statute, then how is it that other entities with similar fiduciary duties are somehow excluded from following the precedent?
Well, no, but you're not contending that the filling out of the complaint in this case was in reliance on that decision,
because
it came later,
because obviously,
right?
The yeah. complaint here was filed in March, and this decision came out in September.
But let me ask you about receivers, though. I mean, receivers really stand in the shoes, don't they, of whoever they're a receiver for, in a way. Here you have two different entities. You've got an owner and you've got a management company, and even though the management company obviously stands in a close relationship, they're not just standing in the shoes of the owner.
Quite the contrary. In fact, more so. The management company here has to be approved by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The principals of the management company have to be sanctioned by HUD as persons that have no conflict and are qualified to handle it. If you look at an order of a receivership that's generated by a common pleas judge or even a federal judge, the order is nowhere as detailed as the management agreement in this case. The owner, in essence, said to the management company, you stand in my shoes, you handle all of the day-to-day responsibilities, and you have a duty. If you fail that duty, you are removed. And that's in the management agreement. So it's actually more of a fiduciary duty than a receiver. If a receiver took over this project, the receiver would have to rely upon the management company, because the management company would be the only entity with expertise in the area of subsidized housing and the receiver would rely upon it. So the fiduciary duty that this management company would, in essence, be imputed to the receiver. So
there's kind of two layers as I see it, to the issue in the case. One is, does it matter whether or not you're one of the persons listed in the statute, 5715.19A? And then the other layer is, does it matter whether somebody who's basically sort of acting as a representative puts themselves in as a complainant or as an agent? Now, your position obviously is that you can be regarded as an appropriate person to represent, and that it doesn't matter that Vistula listed itself as the complainant who was not the owner, rather than as a representative of the owner.
I agree with the court in its articulation of the issues, and I mostly agree with your characterization, except that on the complaint, the intent of filling out the complaint was clearly to indicate that Vistula was representing number one. In other words, line one was Michaelmas Manor Limited Partnership. Line two is complainant other than owner Vistula Management. Line five says, what's your relationship management company? So the intent was to say, hey, we're here on behalf of the owner. I've read that complaint numerous times, and frankly, I'm confused by it. Every time I look at it, and I know there's instructions, and I know counsel has educated me on the instructions, and I, to be honest with you, think I would fill it out the same way again. But I agree with the analysis of Wilkinson, precisely. They went through line one, two, and three, and five of the complaint, and noted the same confusion that was filed, that the receiver did, and they ignored it. They said, well, we'll overlook the procedural and get to the substantive. And the substantive is?
Now, if on that later line, if it had been left blank, if it didn't say management company, if all you had was Michaelmas Manor and then complainant, if not owner,
I would totally agree with you. I would say that my argument would be significantly weaker. Totally agree with you, because then you're not putting anyone on notice of why you're there. But when you put management company down, you're not saying, look, I'm here because I have some interest in the property. I'm their management company. So I agree with you that it raises an issue, but I don't believe, as the BTA agreed in Wilkinson, that it should be a problem. So the other argument that I've made, which is an interesting one, I think, and more than interesting, I think it's substantive, is that if you look at 57-15-13, it says party affected. And you've got the Midland Foods decision, which said that a lessee with a 99-year lease with express language in it that says that they have exclusive duties and responsibilities for filing tax reduction appeals, that they have standing.
This is another BTA decision?
Yes, it is, BTA decision. And I also note in there that the statute says materially affected. Well, if Vistula Management is denied the opportunity to file this, you've now put them in a situation where they've breached their fiduciary duty. It's materially affected their ability to act. And by analogy, although it's not addressed in the Wilkinson decision, if you deprived a court-appointed receiver of filing a tax reduction appeal, you have impugned that receiver's right to follow the statutory mandates that the receiver has. So under 13, I think you have an independent. I see my time is up.
You have a couple more minutes.
Yeah, I think I've gone 13 minutes. So what I would like is the opportunity to preserve the other 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
That'd be fine. Ms. Grigsby.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am Teresa Grigsby here on behalf of the Toledo Public Schools. Today the court is asked to resolve a straightforward issue of jurisdictional standing. The question is whether Vistula Management Company is permitted to file a complaint challenging the taxable value of property, the property that it manages under a contract with the owner. And there are two approaches to this question. The parties have presented the court with two decidedly different views of how to resolve this issue. On the one hand, Toledo Public Schools asked the court to look at the language of the governing statute, 57-15-19, and to then apply that language as written. On the other hand, appellants are asking the court to look at one of its prior decisions, the Dayton Supply case, and to twist it out of context, I would say, and then extend its ruling to fit these facts. Let me talk about the two approaches and explain why the first is right and the second is wrong. The statute, of course, is the starting point for analysis. The statute identifies a comprehensive list of those who may file complaints. If a party does not fit into one of the listed classes on the list, then the analysis stops. The case must be dismissed because there is no jurisdiction. Here, the management company is not included within the pool of statutorily recognized complainants. And note that the General Assembly did not opt to create a generalized category using flexible language like agents or representatives or fiduciaries.
What about the receiver situation? Would that be within the statute or not?
I would argue that the receiver situation is not within the statute, and that the Board of Tax Appeals erred in deciding the Wilkinson case, and in fact that the Board of Tax Appeals recognized that error implicitly when it, in a subsequent case, the 419 case, did not apply the Wilkinson decision. The court simply does not have the flexibility or the latitude to expand the list of authorized complainants. And as I said, I think it's noteworthy that the General Assembly did not opt to use flexible language such as fiduciary or representative or agent. Instead, it specifically enumerated those officers, salaried employees, those non-owners who may file complaints. And I think by defining and confining the list as it has, the General Assembly made certain policy choices which this court should not interfere with. Our position is that simple. Now, as to the position of the management company, let me say that it requires the court to overlook the fact that neither management companies, nor agents, nor fiduciaries, nor representatives in general are authorized by the statute to file complaints. It requires a disregard of the statutory language. Instead, what they're saying is that standing exists by virtue of application of the court's decision in Dayton Supply, because that's where this theory of fiduciary duties emanates. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to look carefully at the Dayton Supply case, because when that is done, it is clear that the position requires the court to twist that decision and distort it to make it work. The facts of that case were that an officer of the company owner filed the complaint, but officers of company owners, corporate owners, are within the list of those set forth in the statute as to who may file complaints. So Dayton Supply does not address whether third parties who are not on the list have standing. Confusion exists because of that opinion, because there is a lengthy discussion within the opinion about why allowing that party to file the complaint is not engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. And it is in that context that the discussion of fiduciary duty arises. So what ultimately occurred in Dayton Supply is that the court set aside its concern that the statute might be unconstitutional, and then it applied the statute as written. It applied it to allow a person within the listed statutory categories to file the complaint. So all of this shows, I think, that a general fiduciary duty analysis is not the way standing is determined. The statute's language controls. The fiduciary duty concept is relevant only insofar as it negates a claim that those persons listed in the statute are engaging in the unauthorized practice of law. And it cannot be used, that fiduciary language cannot be used to create a new category of those with statutory standing. Someday, maybe the General Assembly will seek to do that and will seek to broaden the class to include fiduciaries and agents and the like. But it has not done so, and until it does so, the court should not do so.
What is it? You expressed your view that receivers would not have standing, but would it be necessary to embrace that view to still rule in your favor in this case, or is there a way of distinguishing that?
No, there's a way to distinguish the Wilkinson case, and it is to say that a receiver is very different than a management company. A receiver has statutory duties with which it must comply. And in this case, Vistula's duties are defined by contract. Certainly it's a unique kind of contract, but it is by contract. And I would say this, that a Vistula's job, if it was faithfully carrying out its duty, even assuming it to be a fiduciary, which I reject because it's contractual, but if it was faithfully carrying out its contractual duty to serve the owner, its job was to hire a person who's listed within the statute as the one to bring the complaint. Or its job was to get a representative who is authorized under the statute, a representative of the owner, such as a salaried employee, to sign off on the complaint. Its job was not to substitute itself. There's no oversight on the part of the General Assembly in this case. Vistula speculates that the General Assembly just overlooked the fact that others are hired to perform daily management functions for corporate owners. But I would say just the opposite is true. The legislature, in fact, recognized that in the statute because it granted standing to certain hired hands. It just didn't grant standing to all hired hands.
Well, let me ask you, we talked about there being sort of two aspects of the issue in this case. I want to shift to the other one. Let's say somebody who was on the list in 5715.19A, a corporate officer, somebody who's clearly enumerated there, fills out the complaint and then puts the owner's name and address on line one, then on line two puts itself as complainant, if not owner. Does it matter jurisdictionally whether that person lists itself as complainant or as agent of the owner?
I think it doesn't matter because there are two parties in that case who could have standing. One is the owner itself. Okay. The other is the enumerated person who's acting for the owner recognized by statute.
Okay.
So I think it makes no difference. My point simply is that there are certain hired hands that can perform this function. There are others that cannot. A management company falls within the class of those that may not. If the court is at all concerned about the Wilkinson case, I would say two things. One, that if the Board of Tax Appeals ruling is an improper following of precedent or an improper application of statute, it ought not be applied. But number two, to BTA's credit, it recognized that Wilkinson, I believe, was improperly decided, and hence the more current and the better decision is 419 investment. For those reasons, we would ask that the court affirm the decision of the BTA and remand with instructions to dismiss.
Thank you, Ms. Grigsby. Mr. Wilkins, you have reserved 1 minute, 48 seconds.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would cite the court to yet another example, a guardian. Let's say the property is in the name of a ward who obviously has become infirm or incompetent and now has had a guardian. According to counsel's recitation, the statute would bar the guardian from filing a tax reduction appeal, so there would be no remedy. That's not what the General Assembly envisioned. The General Assembly broadened the scope of persons, and Dayton Supply is a recitation of the intent of the General Assembly. That's my analysis. And I believe that, frankly, it would be an injustice to deny guardians, to deny receivers, to deny management companies of subsidized properties with detailed management agreements and management plans the right to file on behalf of an owner when the benefit benefits the owner. You don't have the negligent filing issues that are addressed in Dayton Supply. Now, the 419 case, there's no written agreement in there. In fact, once again, the distinction is we have a detailed management agreement setting forth fiduciary duties that are not set forth in that decision. Wilkinson was not appealed by this particular BOE. This particular counsel, Mr. Bragg, accepted the Wilkinson decision. It did not even argue in his motion to remand with instructions to dismiss in this case anything about 5715.19. So what do we have here? It's almost like a bootstrapping of the Wilkinson decision as an appeal, which is not filed in this case by the BOE. They want to benefit from the fact that they didn't appeal the Wilkinson decision, and they want to thrust this 57-15-19 argument to this court after the BTA rules in this case, which I find intolerable. I'm sorry, my time is up.
Mr. Wilkins, your time has expired.
And I would ask the court to reverse the decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.